making paper.
Welcome to episode 92 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand paper making and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand paper making studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today I'm talking with Owen Gildersleeve, an artist specializing in handcrafted illustration, set design, and art direction. He has honed his unique style over the past 12 years, bringing graphic designs to life through layers of hand-cut paper and a playful use of depth and shadow. His practice ranges from intricate illustrations to large-scale sets and installations, teaming up with the likes of Apple, Lush, Penguin Books, and NASA. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Owen Gildersleeve, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thanks for having me. It's really nice to be here.
Yeah. I'm so looking forward to learning about your career with paper. So tell me a little bit about where you grew up and how you got into any creative things you did as a kid and how that led to your work with paper. And so to set the stage of where you live now, too. Have you always been
sure.
In the UK?
Yeah, I have. So I grew up in the West Country, sort of near Bristol. And my mum used to be a textiles artist. And my dad was kind of always like a frustrated artist. He'd been pushed away from it by his parents as a kid. But he was always, we go on holidays to the Lake District, sort of northern England, and he'd always be sort of sitting sketching. Uh-huh. And as a kid, I was always fascinated in seeing his sketches because, you know, day to day, he wasn't able to be that creative in his job. And I think just through that, and there's a lot of art in the house, a lot of our artworks were also displayed, you know, early scribbles and things like mm-hmm. that. And also like big collections of records, record sleeves, record art. I think it was just like a real interest and fascination. And so it was interesting. I went down the sort of visual art route, whereas my brother went down the music route. My brother's a musician. Now he's a composer. And yeah, for me, I think just the sort of visual side always fascinated me. I was always interested in my interest developed into like fine art, photography, especially sort of abstract expressionism, you know, that kind of field.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was always interested in being able to see where the artist's hands sort of touched the work.
Mm.
And there's something about the abstract expressionist field of art where it feels very hands-on. Mm-hmm. You get a real sense for the brush strokes and the movement and the energy.
Right.
And yeah, I always just found that really fascinating, you know. And so it's kind of over time developing that interest, also an interest in photography. And then through, I think, the record sleeves, an interest in design. So it's when it came around to sort of uni time, university, sort of what to study.
Mm-hmm.
It was around that time I was looking at sort of various designers' work and found Stefan Sagmeister's work. And he's obviously a designer who works very hands-on, you know, creating posters for events, but it's all made of coffee cups, which are filled with different quantities or colors of coffee to then make a bigger design. You know, it's really, really interesting, hands-on, playful approach. And I think through finding that work, I realized actually I didn't have to separate things out. I didn't have to go down the fine art or photography or design route. I could actually bring them all together.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was through that I sort of pursued the graphic design route. I studied at Brighton.
Okay.
And realized I could just, bring everything together and I could actually sort of work by, you know, using my hands, but then photograph it and then still have that kind of graphic side, which I was always fascinated in.
Right. So I have a question about just your use of the computer prior to going, like you grew up with the computer, I'm assuming. And
Yeah, I did. Just about.
Okay.
you know, it was like early days internet, sort of like, you know, modem load up sort of stuff. Okay. But yeah, we did have a computer. And I did spend a fair bit of time on it as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But yeah, not to the levels of nowadays where, you know, like we didn't have social media when I was at uni.
Right.
That wasn't around, which I think may have been helpful for, you know, just a bit less distraction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about the photography? Was that digital? Did you start digital?
No.
Okay.
Actually, at my school, we were really lucky. Our photography teacher, we actually had photography as an option for my A levels. My photographer teacher was just an amazing woman who, I think she was the only teacher that the head teacher was more scared of than the other way around. And so she managed to push, and she had a black and white and color darkroom in school. So from an early age, I got to learn how to develop my own photos, both in the black and white and color setup, which was amazing. So yeah, really getting to grips with not only taking the photos and the composition, but actually the process of like developing them and, you know, exposure times and learning all of the little details you need to know. So yeah, I felt very fortunate to have like a very hands-on approach to art and photography from an early age.
Right. So then so you studied graphic design, and sort of what happened through that course and your early career? How did that take off?
So I studied at the University of Brighton, which interestingly is now where I am again. So I'm back in Brighton now, sort of many years later. Brighton was a really interesting course. And what grabbed me was it was quite a conceptual course. So although we were studying design, it was more about the idea, and the execution was always allowed to be quite playful. Mm. So I was creating posters, say, for a set brief, but I was going into the black and white dark rooms in the photography suite and creating photograms, you know, sort of actually creating cut out stencils and then developing these photograms, and the final poster would be a one-off photogram. Or spilling paint down walls in our student house, or, you know, just really sort of like playful hands-on approaches, and they really loved that. And we were kind of pushed to experiment. I think it did lead to, when I left uni, having just such a cluster of a portfolio that there was no, it wasn't like a set style or idea. But I'm kind of glad of that, because I think sometimes students get caught up in the idea that they need to finish uni with a real set portfolio. And I think actually university and studying is a time for experimentation. Mm-hmm. You can kind of define your style later.
Right. That's what So what did you go on to do after you graduated?
After graduating, actually, I think partly because of having such a mix of a portfolio, I wasn't really sure where to go. We were studying design, and a lot of our tutors had been pushing us to maybe get jobs in design studios. And I'd done a few internships at design studios, but it hadn't clicked with me. I just didn't get on with it that well. But it was interesting. They hadn't really pushed the idea of freelancing as a concept. It wasn't really advertised within the course as much. So around the time of finishing university, I started looking around at artists I admired, and I found one called Mario Hugo, who he actually runs a design studio in New York now called Hugo and Marie. And he's an amazing artist. And something about his work really captivated me. I think I've always been interested in typography as well, and he had a lot of real interesting tactile type in his portfolio. Although more digital, but just, there's something about the mood, the aesthetic, which I always loved. And so I just reached out to him and asked if he was interested in or looking for anyone to come and help out. And he offered me a 3-month internship in New York. Oh. So when I graduated, I went to New York for 3 months. And I have to say that was like the starting point, I think, for everything for me, because I'd never got to witness a freelance artist before in their world, and actually spending 3 months with Mario, getting to see his studio, getting to see how it worked, just even overhearing conversations about budgets, mm-hmm. you know, how yeah. to talk to clients, just right. stuff like that. Yeah, which is so exciting. And I think for me, it also played a bit into my ego, I guess, in that I liked that he was given, putting his name, his stamp on all his projects as well. Uh-huh. And like the sort of design studio setup, like everything he did was Mario Hugo. And I found that really exciting that you could be yourself as an artist, but you could also work with a huge array of clients and have your own, you know, you be your own boss. Yeah. And so, yeah, after 3 months doing that, I was sold. And as soon as I got back, I was home for a little while and then decided to move to London and just give it a go for myself.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, that's adventurous to just reach out. But I think that's how it happens for a lot of people. But that's how cool yeah. that you were looking at work that you liked. And I think that's really valuable for artists to, yeah, see how someone yeah. else did it. And just,
I think it's so important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And groundwork. Mm-hmm.
I think it's something I say to students as well when I'm, you know, giving lectures and things. It's like, not to be afraid of reaching out to people. And it's not, you know, it doesn't have to just be clients. It's like, if there's artists you admire, mm-hmm. just give them a shout, get to mm-hmm. see if you can pop into their studio, even just for a quick visit, a coffee, or maybe an internship or something. But those little moments of contact where you just get to pick up snippets of information are so invaluable. And it's helped me massively. And I'd recommend it to anyone looking to get into the industry, just to reach out to those people who you like, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, fascinating. Wow. So moving to London. Wow, that sounds like a bold move too. Just establishing yeah. yourself. And how did that all work out?
It was good. I think so. Interestingly, with the trip, I think a lot of other students had cottoned on to the fact we'd gone to New York. And even though I went with one friend to begin with, there was ended up at one point being like 15 of us in New York together. Uh-huh. And I think and we're all just staying in this little two-bed flat. We'd all crammed in. It was kind of that sort of vibe. It was really fun.
Yeah.
But I think the energy between us all was just, you know, how much we enjoyed being in the city and you know, really sort of living in that lifestyle. And I think I realized that from going to that back to the West Country, Cheddar Gorge, where I'm from, it was just such a throwback to mm-hmm. another time for me that, yeah, I felt like it was just the obvious move was to get back into a city life, and actually going from Brighton to London just felt like the right step. They're quite close sort of mm-hmm. geographically in the UK. And yeah, interestingly, I saw a friend of mine had posted something up saying they were looking for another person to start a shared house. And I thought I'd go for it. And it worked out really well. I think you just have to throw yourself into those scenarios because right. I feel like, especially with a big move, like moving to a city, whether it be London or LA or New York or Paris or, you know, wherever you are, Berlin, you kind of just got to trust in yourself that you'll find your feet. And I'd always done a lot of bar work. I used to work in a lot of pubs in mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. my village growing up as a kid. And so I kind of knew that as soon as I got to London, I just went to all of the pubs I could find and just found some bar work to keep me going. And I was working at a couple of different pubs. And then from there, I managed to get a bit of part-time work. There's a publisher in the UK called No Brow Press, who mm-hmm. are like an illustration publisher. Mm-hmm. Managed to get a few days a week there. And then it just kind of picked up. And then my freelance work started kicking off. And I kind of, with the freelance thing, I have to hark back to the uni days again, because one thing I haven't mentioned is a few friends and I during our course, as kind of an outlet and somewhere to put our experimentations and projects, we started a little group website called Evening Tweed. It was just a silly thing, but it was like four of us. We put all our work together. I think that kind of having a name and it being a collective, and we kind of started sharing contacts. And so people would come to see one of us, our work, and then see the rest of us. And I think it really helped build up a bit of a profile. And it did mean we started getting a few commissions. So by the time that I'd already done a few in the early days towards, I mean, like right after uni. But it meant by the time I got to London, I had like a couple of paid commissions under my belt, not loads, but just enough to be like, there's something here to explore. And it just started picking up and kind of, so that was rolling underneath my London move and the sort of working at pubs and various other things. And it just started picking up, really.
Did you have a studio? You were just working out of your home?
Working from a bedroom. Kind of a classic. That was the case for many years, actually. But I was happy with it. I was just, you know, I didn't have enough money coming to afford a studio. I eventually did move into a studio space a few years later, as work started picking up. And it was, again, just through the contacts we'd made, other creatives who'd moved to the city around the same time. And we, there's a space going, it was a real dive, you know, no heating, no hot water, real bad mouse infestation. I don't think the landlord paid any business rates. So there was constantly like bailiff letters coming through asking if people were in there working, but it was very cheap. And it allowed us a place to work outside of our house. And, you know, it felt like a good stepping stone, meeting other creatives, that sort of thing.
Right, right. So is there like, I mean, you are prolific today. So it's great to hear the backstory, but have won so many awards and just are doing such innovative, interesting work that we're going to talk about. But was was that just a gradual thing, or was there like one commission that like put you on the map, or is it just kind of steady?
Yeah, I think it just been a steady thing. Mm-hmm. There hasn't been, not maybe such a single project, but just, I don't know, just getting excited about what you do and trying to be passionate about it. And, I think I've always had a bit of a excitable, slightly relentless energy on projects and things that I'm into, you know. I find it hard to put my tools down, and I find it hard to like switch off from it, which is something in later years nowadays I'm trying to work on, having a bit more headspace, you know, now being a dad and family and all of that. But I remember at the time, especially first few years of being in London, just being very into trying to find my feet and trying to get the work in and trying to, you know, a lot of long hours, like all nighters at the studio, just finishing projects up and things like that. I think just over time, just also, as I mentioned earlier, not being scared to reach out to people. Mm-hmm. So there'd be a lot of going around with my portfolio, even when it was very, very underdeveloped, just turning up at, you know, agencies I respected and just trying to get some feedback on my work. And I found out those little bits, you know, them maybe pointing out a hole I had in my portfolio would help. And also personal work. I think that's probably one of the key things is that I've always done a lot of personal work. And I found actually some of my best projects, the most exciting projects I've had in my career, have come off the back of personal work. And I think that's probably the biggest thing is actually just doing that personal work a lot, even, no matter how busy I've been. I don't know. I just find that people see that and they see the passion. It's not linked to a brand. So it hasn't got like a logo on it, or like it hasn't had some other creatives like tearing apart of the idea. And I think the personal projects have led to some of the most interesting things. So there's a lot of that.
Okay. Well, let's dive into some of the work that you've done, and it'll just be a little bit, but listeners, he has a great showcase and portfolio on his website that we'll link to in the show notes. Let's let's talk about illustrations. And you illustrated the cover of my new book, The Art of Papercraft, which is exciting. But you've done quite a few book illustrations or book cover designs, right? And how did that come about?
I've always found a book cover as a format really fascinating because it's such a nice container for an illustration. You know, it's so perfect. And also, I think having an interest in typography, it's been quite nice being able to just take over the whole cover. You know, something that I've really enjoyed. But I hadn't done a book cover actually until I did my own book, Papercut.
Okay.
So I think that was my first book cover.
Oh, okay.
Which is funny. Sometimes you have to like create your projects, you know, to fill the gap, and then stuff comes off the back of that. But it was always something I'd love, and I've always gone to a lot of bookstores and just been fascinated by all the covers. And,
well, and you mentioned your interest in records too.
The
record, a sleeve, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of that kind of contained format, but
right,
you know, and it's such a beautiful thing to have and to hold. And I'm really glad that, you know, books, publishing, reading, it seems to me there's actually been a bit of a resurgence of like physical books again, you know, away from like digital formats, which is great. It was lovely to work on your stunning book recently. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So let's just briefly talk about the process for the creation.
Sure.
And it's actually described because my book is about paper and Owen is a paper illustrator. this is described in the back cover or somewhere on the book.
Yeah, sure. Well, so I guess the process for creating all of my illustrations is quite similar in that I always start with a range of pencil sketches, just getting down my ideas. Mm-hmm. And I find that no matter who I'm working with, it's just nice to supply at least two, maybe three different routes, just to let people make some choices. And those are always really rough, but they just get the ideas down. And I try and treat projects quite collaboratively. So there's always a bit of a conversation about the different options. And once the route is chosen, I draw everything up digitally in Illustrator, which just allows me to refine the forms, add color. And what's really important as a maker is it allows some rounds of feedback and amends before I begin making, which is obviously so important because, you know, once you start cutting and making, it's quite hard to make changes. It can be very lengthy. Once everything's approved, I mean, my style is it's like multi-layered and quite graphic. So it's actually quite straightforward in terms of transferring the line work, like printing the line work backwards onto the paper and then cutting the sheets out. And so when you spin it around, you don't see the line work. And it's a very, almost like an exact replica of the approved Illustrator drawings, but just with lots of layers and nice textures and nice hand cut forms.
Right.
A lot of my work's hand cut. Some of it I use a digital cutter, like a silhouette cutter.
Right.
If I'm doing mass making, there's some jobs where I'm just having to create so much.
Right.
That, you know, things are still formed by hand and brought together, but the actual cutting side is helpful to have, a bit, I guess, an extra pair of hands on that front. But I also have assistants in my studio that help as well. So it depends on the job.
Right.
And then for your cover, for example, that was all, so hand cut, and then it was built together using layers of foam board to add depth. And then I actually photograph the artwork in my studio just using natural light. I don't have any lights in my studio at all. My camera, I don't even have a tripod. I just kind of stand over the work with a digital SLR, take a few snaps, and then I'll bring it into Photoshop and then retouch the image. And I'll quite often compose it of a few parts because I've found over time it's helpful to have layers because sometimes you want to make amends to one bit. And, you know, if you have it separated out, you can actually sort of tweak things separately. Uh-huh. It's not just a single shot that you have to deal with. And it's a bit easier for retouching. I guess because I'm a bit of a perfectionist as well. You know, like with your cover, we had this swirling background, and then we had a top layer of paper. I just wanted to make sure it was all crisp. So I had the background as a separate sheet.
I
had the top layer as a separate, and you sort of build in shadows. And then that also means that we can animate the pieces as well, because the final file that's delivered could be layered. And so with some pieces, it would just be a couple of layers, but some projects I've worked on in the past, they'll want everything totally layered, so that we can then supply the file to like an After Effects animator, and then they can bring it to life in After Effects. And I guess it avoids the whole stop frame thing, which I know is quite a sort of, it's a lengthy process, you know. So it's, I guess, less hands-on in that respect, but it does mean that the final animation is almost an exact replica of the artwork, because it's using the same artwork file, you know.
Right. And there's something on your website, maybe you'll remember, because I don't remember exactly. It's a series of animations where you see the blank, just a color, and then it builds up. What are those pieces?
It was, so that was actually, book covers as well.
Book covers,
for Earth Friends.
Right.
It was a Nosy Crow series. Yeah, and that was just, I mean, that was quite simple in terms of just building up the layers from back to front. But it just showed the process, and also just showed the possibilities with having this layered file approach, because you can actually build everything up and then you can be playful with the final outcome. Right. And I think nowadays as well, so many people want a little motion piece for social media, and
Right.
So it's good to keep that in mind, I think.
Yeah. Well, fascinating. And I don't know what, because you dealt with the publisher for my book cover. We did not deal directly. We're just meeting today for the first time. And I don't know what they told you, but I'm going to spill the beans. You know, the storybooks, they do a lot of in-house design. So the designer was looking at your work and attempted to do a cover design, and they showed it to me, and I didn't make the connection to you. I'm sorry, because I was familiar with your, I knew your book, but not your work so much. But anyways, I said, you know, there's so many paper illustrators out there. Would you be willing to hire someone to do the cover? It's such an important part of the book. And so they talked to her, and she had been looking at your work, and so they approached you, which was cool.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Thanks for fighting my corner.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure,
I mean, that does happen,
that there are knockoffs and things like that. Yeah. People.
Yeah. But there's a lot of that, you know. Mm-hmm. I think especially in-house design teams, you know, will try and rebuild something in their style, but you know, I think you can always tell the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as you said, the guy that you worked for in New York, he built his brand. You have your brand. Yeah. You can tell. Cool. So, what about, you do so many different kinds of projects. So like, I was looking at your website and picked out the Nissan Juke. Tell me about that project.
I think one thing I've been keeping in mind over the years is when you start getting jobs on and you know what the final outcome will be, I think it's a sign that maybe you're stuck in a bit, or I found anyway, in a bit of a rut. And so it's really nice when those jobs come along, which really throw you off. And I found the Nissan job was one of those, you know, it actually really scared me when they approached me, because they, you know, were very upfront and just said, we've had this idea for a project. Nissan have already bought into it. Would you be able to make a life-size car out of paper? And it was like, oh, okay, you know, right. This has all been approved. I think I've just found over time that the jobs that scare me the most are the ones to take on, because it's a sign you've been pushed out of your comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And so I sort of said, yeah, okay. And then it was a case of finding the right people to help make it happen. And actually, one of the great things about Brighton University as well was, as well as the experimental side, was there was a real intermixing of courses. And so we had a lot of friends, you know, I had friends who were illustrators, who were photographers, who were artists, and who were in the 3D side. One of those friends, a guy called Thomas Forsyth, he studied WMCP, which is, it's not very catchy, titled Wood, Metal, Ceramics and Plastics.
Okay.
That was his course. And he's always been a great friend since university, and he's really great with larger scale 3D builds. And I immediately gave him a call and said, look, I've had this job come in. I need to create this car life-size out of paper. And it was funny, he just wasn't fazed by the size of the car or anything. He was more just thinking about the logistics. And it felt like a really great team up because I was coming with my paper knowledge. Tom was coming with his 3D building knowledge, because I hadn't really ever done any like CAD drawings or anything like that before, whereas Tom was a dab hand at that. And so lots of conversations with Nissan. We got some 3D models shared, and we managed to create this kind of low poly version of their car. And then Tom worked out this really interesting kind of skeleton, I guess, which was just slotted together large sheets of foam board, you know, kind of in
it's foam board. So it's called, it's like a, I mean, in paper engineering, there's something called a slice form, but it it collapses flat. Yours didn't. Yours just stayed. And there are pictures on Owen's website of this.
There's a bit of a cheesy video actually of us piecing it together where they got me to do the voiceover like on the like the last day of the shoot, and they're like, oh, Owen, maybe you could do a voiceover. Yeah. Oh my god. But yeah, so we created this sort of foam core or foam board structure, and then built the paper shell over the top. I mean, we started with a scale model. We did like a quarter size car to begin with.
Right.
We had a very, very scary meeting at Nissan HQ where we brought a paper model of like one of the designer's cars and he spent like 15 minutes examining it, just being but he was really happy. And then, then we had to build the car, but not only that, we had to build it to camera over 2 days. So they decided, just to throw another curveball in, they thought it would be nice to capture it for a film. So we've kind of made everything, but we haven't pieced it together actually until the film shoot in the studio, which is a bit nerve-wracking, but it came together. It all fitted together, which is good.
Wow. So what was the largest piece of paper? Was it all fairly small piece sections or?
Well, actually that one, some of the pieces are pretty big. I mean, as you guess, because it is low poly, the triangular forms were not too massive, but like the windscreen was quite a large sheet and other pieces. And so what we were having to do is we were hand cutting a fair bit, but we also found a printers which would do cutting off sheets. And so I guess another thing which has been good about my use of, say, Illustrator to do all my drawings is it was a very similar process for the car, in that we actually found a program called PepperCura. Have you heard of PepperCura?
No.
It's like a Japanese program, very low tech, but it's an amazing program for breaking 3D models into nets.
Okay.
It was an absolute lifesaver.
Yeah.
So we put sections of the 3D model that Tom had designed into PepperCura. And then you just click render, and then it'll be like, here's the net. And it had all the tabs in it. But then we had to then export those into Illustrator, then send them off, and we sent them to a company to sort of die cut, cut using like a large cutter. And then we got them all sent to us at the studio to build.
Okay.
So yeah, it was a bit of a process, but it was a real challenge, but we learned a lot. And it's kind of, it led to a lot of interesting, we did some pieces after that at the Silicon Valley Comic Con, where we were building like a life-size Iron Man 1 year, and then we did a K2SO model. So it's interesting how these like projects come in, and then they sort of lead to a whole wave of new types of work, you know?
Right. Because other people see them and want to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Wonderful.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here and I want to let you know that my new book, The Art of Papercraft, is now out in the world. The book offers a rich variety of projects that will delight crafters, artists, and designers alike, including paper votive lights, pop-up cards, folded paper gift boxes and envelopes, woven paper wall hangings, miniature one-sheet books, and much more. If you'd like an autographed copy, you can order that directly from me at HelenHebertStudio.com. And if the autograph doesn't matter to you, the book is available wherever fine books are sold. It's also available on Kindle. And by the way, my book, Papermaking with Garden Plants and Common Weeds, has also just been released on Kindle. And my other papermaking book, The Papermaker's Companion, has been available on Kindle for a couple of years. Now back to our conversation.
Tell me a little bit about your studio now and how projects come in. You must turn some projects down. How do you choose? And then your staff, is that just, does it ebb and flow? Or do you have permanent, some like full-time staff? And
it ebbs and flows. I quite like the flexibility of not having like too much tied down to the studio. Mm-hmm. I did have a studio manager at one stage, part-time, but I kind of quite enjoy the flexibility of taking a work on when I'm wanting to take a work on and not having too many overheads, you know.
Right.
And then I have some really great assistants who are fairly regular, like a day or two a week, and they'll come into the studio and help out with admin-y bits or making, if there's making to do. It's been quite steady. The last few years have been fairly steady, which has been good. Obviously, there was the lockdown and COVID time,
right.
where kind of everyone down tools for a while. But around, other than that, it's been a nice place where there is always kind of a couple of projects on. And sometimes I do have to turn down work, mm-hmm. but that tends to just be, I guess, like editorial jobs and things like that, where maybe the time frames are just unrealistic or or budgets aren't unrealistic, you know. It's good. It feels in a nice place. It feels, as I mentioned, I think earlier, I've only recently moved to Brighton again after about 15 years in London.
Okay.
And I think it was, again, during lockdown, just needing to get out of the big city with a two-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. Needing a bit more outdoor space for him. Mm-hmm. And so my wife and I and my child, Arlo, we thought we'd come back down to the seaside again. And I found a studio actually on the equivalent of Craigslist in the US.
Oh, okay.
Called Gumtree.
Uh-huh.
Crazy place to find a studio, you know, unexpected, but it's amazing. And it's got two floors. And it's kind of perfect. It's right in the center of town. So it's a really nice, it's the sort of place I would never have been able to find or afford in London. So it's the joy of being out of the big city, you know?
Yeah. And then your assistants can commute. You said it wasn't that far. So you assistants you're able to, or
no, actually. So it's, we've had a bit of a, bit of a fresh start because it is, it's like an hour to London, but it's enough for some freelance work, you know, where you want them to come in a couple of days a week or on a bit, sometimes a bit last minute. It's nice having sort of a bit of a local setup. And I've been really fortunate to find some really great people.
Well, through the university, there must be.
Yeah. So one is actually studying, a girl mm-hmm. called Imogen. Uh-huh. She's studying. And then the guy called Jack is, he's graduated like a few years later. Jack Snelling,
okay.
Imogen Donegan. Going to give them a shout out because I feel like they deserve it.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you're so generous in your Instagram posts. You always give a shout out to whoever helped on your projects. I really enjoy that.
Thanks. I think it's so important because I just think it's over years being involved in stuff and I just know how it feels when people do it to you, mm-hmm. you know, when, and I think everyone should get back credit because there's never like just one individual on the job. There's always multiple people helping. I think it's good. I'm actually remember when I was working with Mario back in New York, just the one time I got a little shout out from him, it was like, oh my God, this,
yeah,
you know, I felt really, even though I was just like the little assistant guy in the corner. So, yeah,
right.
It was good.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, well, you've used different kinds of technology in your work, and I was really intrigued by the window display Lush and the technology of the flowers blooming. Tell me a little bit about that project.
That was really fun. That was kind of a nuts one again, because it kind of came a few years after the Nissan job, and they were interested in creating an array of windows for their multiple stores around Europe. I think it was 13 different windows, but they wanted like a hero display for their Oxford Street store in London, which is like their main space. And so it was kind of like the difference, I guess, compared to the Nissan job was it was a bit more mass making, because we were recreating sort of similar elements and then working out shipping logistics. And so there's lots of these big flowers made of paper on these wooden stands that they could just really easily put together. I had to draw out some instructions for them. But for the London store, we thought it'd be fun to push it further. And actually, I again reached out to Tom Forsyth, and said, I've got this job on. I wonder if we can, is there anything interesting we could do? And Tom had, in that time between jobs, been playing with Arduinos and like digital technology. And he'd been playing with a bit of coding. And so he'd created this code which allowed these flowers to kind of like look around the windows at passers-by with these little built-in sort of sensors. And so I think I'd seen him do it on another job, and it was like, we need to try, and can we do this for this one?
Yeah.
And he built it in. And so I think there was maybe like five or six of these flowers had moving heads in the window. And it was amazing. It just really brought the display to life. And it was kind of, just interesting. Again, just pushing things the next step a bit further, you know, see where you can take it.
Yeah. So using the Arduinos, so the sunflowers would actually react to where someone
is. They're kind of like looking around the windows. Yeah. And because he'd been playing with this like color tracking technology, which is really fascinating. So it was amazing. And it's, I guess it just shows the importance of collaboration. It's always been really important for me, but I feel like when you collaborate and bring people together, the ideas always go a stage further than you would have maybe, you know, got to just by yourself.
Totally agree with that. I'm doing a project with a library now, and I'm thinking about, I'm building a giant paper lantern that will hang in the library, but I want them to pull books off of their shelves that relate to light and have them around the lantern. And you tell that to the librarian and they get excited. And so
that's such a nice idea.
Things just grow. I love what you're saying about collaboration. Yeah, I totally
agree. And it's like, whether it's with another creative or with a client, you know, just treating it a bit like a conversation.
Exactly.
Because everyone's always got some interesting input or idea that's just like, oh, wow, okay, you know.
So, yeah.
And
they're invested and feel good if they're part of the process too. So it's just all it's a win-win. Okay. Well, I love the work of James Turrell, and you did, is it an album cover? What was the project?
Was. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Tell me about that. Amnioverse.
Yeah.
Lapalux.
Yeah. So, it was interesting. This one came off the back of a personal project. So we're talking about the importance of personal work.
Yeah.
I realized there's a bit of a gap in my portfolio for like set design, architectural builds.
Mm-hmm.
And so a photographer friend and I decided to team up a guy called Stephen Lenthal and just create a little personal series. And it was all white paper sets shot with really hard lighting to create this kind of real contrast of light and shadow. And it's called Shadow Spaces, the series. It was funny, he'd actually hired in some lights but realized they weren't quite hard enough, so there was a bit of a soft shadow still. And through playing over 2 days, he realized actually the light on his phone was perfect. It was so hard, so he just rigged up a phone, some really long exposures, and it created these really like atmospheric scenes. So that was kind of just a fun project. Put it on my website, And then a few, well, I guess it was a few years later, it was, I think, another photographer who was teaming up with Lapalux, so artist Lapalux on Ninja Tunes, had seen the work and had presented it to Lapalux and said, I think this would be really cool for your cover to create something in this vein. Because his album was all kind of, it's electronic, it's very futuristic, it's kind of inspired by the idea of this kind of like portal. And they had this idea of creating this visual of a lady walking down into this kind of like pink, I guess, glowing tunnel, you know? And you could obviously do it digitally, but they were had seen the project I'd done where it was all made of paper. Wondered if we could do it for real. And so there was a lot of conversation, but we realized actually by creating this paper set with, it was just like an array of kind of hexagonal, I guess, like arches, but shrinking in size to push the perspective to make it seem even larger. And then in the studio space, which was literally just a spare room in the photographer's house, you know, a lot of the shoots and things I do behind the scenes are quite, you know, a bit bodged sometimes, but I don't, you don't need an amazing setup. And then we just flooded it with, got a smoke machine, flooded it with smoke, got these pink lights, and just pumped all of the energy through. And what was nice, a photographer had gone a step further and done a photo shoot with a model, various poses, but what one was kind of her walking into a distance. And I had then taken those, printed them out at different sizes. And then I had like quite a small one, which we just placed in the set. And it was perfect. It just suddenly made the scale just feel, you know, like you're right in this space with her. And so we photographed that, and then like, just a little bit of retouching to really push her looking, you know, rather than just like a cut out her to look like it was her in the space. Yeah, that was great. It was a really fun project. And what's nice is people do see it and they do think it's digital, but then you see the behind the scenes and it's like we did do it. And I think those little imperfections that you just wouldn't put into a digital file, you know, where the lines aren't quite perfect, I guess help bring it to life.
And I mentioned James Turrell. I just wanted to cycle back to that because on your website it said somebody, the artist maybe, spent 3 years or something going every day to see the James Turrell installation at Rice University in Houston.
Well, actually, so he
That's
actually had a postcard of it above his
Oh,
space where he was composing the album,
okay. Oh, okay.
and
That's
every day for 3 years he'd be staring at this
Ah.
picture. And so yeah, that's yeah. So that kind of glow, the pink glow that we were trying to capture, was really inspired by this, just his postcard that he had over his desk
Yeah,
while he
okay.
was
Wow.
composing. And so it was kind of trying to bring that kind of. I mean, his work is so incredible, where it's just it really absorbs you. And I think it was just trying to capture that mood and feel in the work.
Let's just talk a little bit about working with agents. I know you have one in the UK and one in the US, I think. And how did that come about, and how do you get all of your work through agents now, or is it piecemeal?
It's a bit split. I first signed to an agent maybe when I was maybe 4 or 5 years in. I think one thing I think it's quite important is for you to find your footing before getting an agent, because I think sometimes there's a bit of a rush, especially out of university, to get signed. And actually, the hard thing is once you get signed, they're going to push the style you're sitting in at that time. Whereas actually, it's maybe nice to give yourself a moment. And I definitely needed a moment out of university to work out who I was, what I wanted to do. And then, yeah, I was fortunate to sign to an agency at that time. And it's, I think it's really helpful. I mean, it's really nice having the support from the agencies to manage the work when you've got it in. But also, I think it's really important you don't put all your I don't know, just step back from self-promoting yourself and expect the agent to bring all your work to you, because actually it's a real give and take with an agency. You know, it's basically joining a family and you're giving them as much as they're giving you. And obviously they're bringing you work, but you also need to put work back into them because it's kind of like you're feeding each other. So I'm now with two amazing, I'm with Grand Matter in the UK, Levine Levette in the US. With Levine Levette, actually, that took a while to get onto. They were an agency I'd been admiring from afar for many years. And eventually plucked up my courage to contact them. Mm-hmm. And at first they said no, you know, I don't think I was quite ready. And so over a course of about a year and a half, I just kind of kept in touch because there was no one else I wanted to sign with. You know, I was just really interested in them. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of tried not to get too disheartened and just kept in touch. And every few months I'd send them a little work update, say hi. And I think it was actually the Nissan job, doing the Nissan job, sending that. And then around that time, contacting them as I would do every few months and them turning around being like, actually, would you be interested in a chat? And I was like, oh. And I think they appreciated and respected that I hadn't just, when they first said no, just run off somewhere else and just found, I showed that I was committed to them. And I think, I don't know, I'm really glad I stuck with my guns because I kind of, it's hard to find those agencies with small select rosters. You know, I haven't just filled them up with like, you know, there'll be like five or six paper cut artists on the same books, you know. And it felt like, yeah, I sort of, it's nice to just sort of, I guess, nurture the people who you're interested in. And, you know, and I kind of knew I wasn't in a massive rush. It was like, you go with the people or just like surround yourself with people that you want to be associated with. I guess that's what's really important.
Yeah. And yeah. I think also, yeah, not taking no for an answer. Like it wasn't, a definite no, you kept in touch. That's so great. What was it about them that you knew you wanted to work with them? Just the work you saw coming out of there and yeah.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. the artists are just of such high caliber. Yeah. The work they're doing, the fact that the roster was only like 10 artists, 10 photographers at the time, you know, it was really selective. Mm-hmm. No other paper artists on the books. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I have to say it's been interesting because I don't know how you feel, obviously the other side of the pond, but I feel like paper arts picked up within the last maybe 5 or so years as a sort of a viable illustration creative sort of mm-hmm. method. Mm-hmm. And so I think actually for them, when I first reached out to them, there wasn't much paper art happening in sort of the creative sphere in the US. And so it probably was a bit of a weird curveball for them, just being like, well, that's maybe why they didn't have a paper artist on their books. Right. But I've definitely found work seems to have been picking up a lot in terms of like the commercial sphere. And I'm just glad that I sort of stuck with my guns. They're a great bunch. They brought a lot of interest and work in as well because, you know, they're just really friendly with their clients. And I think, again, it's just about relations and like building up your network.
Well, we didn't really talk about how you got into using paper as an illustration.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Let's do that. And we don't have a lot of time left, but I have a few more questions. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, I started off by playing with lots of different materials, but I remember getting a brief where a lot of my pieces were just formed type with found materials. But then I got a brief where they wanted a more illustrative piece made. And I realized that I kind of needed to find something to transfer design onto rather than just forming something out of lots of elements. And obviously paper is the obvious choice. You can transfer your design onto it. It's very easy to come by, you know? And I think at the time this is postgraduate, it's not a lot of money. So it's quite cheap material. You have it everywhere. And it's also easy to start again if you make mistakes, you know? And so I did this kind of paper cut piece. I probably had seen a bit of it around, and so it inspired me. But it's interesting. I was at home at the time. I'd come back from my New York trip, and I remember making the piece, and my brother looked at it, and I was like, "What do you think?" And he was like, "Have you tried adding any layers to it just to bring it off the table?" Uh-huh. And I was like, "Oh!" And I used a bit of foam board to bring it off the page. Mm-hmm. I think it's like I've got literally that's my career. It's all odes to my brother.
Right.
Yeah. It's funny. And yeah, this is just on a kitchen table in my house, at my home. And right. I photographed it, and that went up on my website when it was done. And I think the nature of these things is you have a piece. If someone's interested in it, they'll commission you for a similar looking piece or right. similar style. And before I knew it, my whole portfolio was filled with paper-based projects. So I never intended to be a paper artist.
Right.
It just was, you know, the right material for a project.
Yeah.
And then suddenly that was it. You know, I was doing paper stuff.
Right. And tell me about the papers you use. Have you pretty much just stayed with the same paper? Are you experimental?
Yeah, I'm quite experimental. I mean, uh-huh. There's a couple of brands which I come back to a lot, like Canford, Murano. Murano is more of a watercolor stock.
Right.
But also because of the nature of my work, I tend to design based on my designs, and then I'll find the paper colors as mm-hmm. close as I can. But in my photography sort of retouch stage, I'll push the color to match my design.
Right.
So I try not to be limited by the colors of paper available. Like I'm kind of just designing, I'm creating my palettes, and then I'll make the piece. But then I know that I can shove it one way or the other and adjust it if need to be. And I guess that's good for companies as well, because they may have like a brand red or green, or you know, they may have a color which needs to be matched. But yeah, I just kind of, if I see paper, if I'm in a stationery store and I see a sheet of paper I like the look of or I like the texture of, I'll just buy it. Mm-hmm. And I've got a big plan chest in my studio, and it's just all color separated, you know, reds, greens, blues, and there's just tons of different shades, types and styles and shades mm-hmm. and different grains as well. Because mm-hmm. sometimes you want something loads of grain because you want it to look more crafty. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you want very little grain because you want it to look very graphic and crisp. So it's just finding the right material. And yeah, I guess over time, doing this enough, you just acquire a lot. And I think that's my big issue now, is just having too much of it. Uh-huh. So I'm trying to like slim down on the.
Right. Yeah. I can imagine. And so how did your book Paper Cut come about? And I think I told you this when I first wrote to you. I found it very helpful in my new book, The Art of Papercraft. I sort of talk about all the different genres of paper art and paper craft, and paper cutting is a very old one and very popular today. So your book is what I referred to when I was just looking for a little bit of information about paper cutting.
Thank you. Yeah, it was it just came out the blue. It was a bit of a surprising one actually, because it was also fairly early in, I guess I've been doing this for like 15 years now or so, and it came in the first five. So it still felt like I was kind of finding my feet somewhat. But a publisher approached me, and they had this book they wanted writing, and they asked if I wanted to do it. And I initially turned it down. I said no, because I was like, I'm not the right person for this. Mm-hmm. You know, the longest thing I'd ever written was my dissertation at uni, which being on an art course was like 1,000 or so words. You know, but I then sort of stepped back, and I realized actually I was just really scared about it. You know, I was just very nervous. I think that was one of my earliest realizations that, you know, as I said earlier, the things that scare you the most is a sign you're being pushed out of your comfort zone. So I went back and I said, actually, I've changed my mind. I hope you haven't gone to anyone else yet. And they're like, no, if you want to do it. And I said yes. And so I decided that it would be a really nice opportunity to learn about my craft, to learn about paper cutting. So I did like a short history, you know, researching, mm-hmm. you know, where it came from, you know, growing up, sort of starting off in in China as a kind of like decorative festival format, and then actually then flown through Europe and becoming more of like an art form. It was really fascinating learning about that and why it is, you know, here as an art form now. But also reaching out to a range of artists which I really respected, sort of like my peers. And I guess what was nice is before then, a lot of those artists I kind of saw as competitors, because I would often be up against them for jobs.
Right.
You know, I'd get a commission in and I'd be pitching against at least one of them most of the time. But it suddenly became just a, like a really good group of friends. Like we, I held a little exhibition in London because I felt like if I was going to do a book with that many talented artists, it would be nice to do a show with them if I could. And it was just amazing. I have a tendency of dragging things out when I do big projects like this. So I'll put on the show. I had work being shipped over from all over the world. I did talks, workshops, things like that. But it was really fun and just a really nice chance to meet some amazing artists and to learn about my craft as well.
Yeah. So the book features many contemporary artists using paper cutting as their
And I guess the sort of style, I guess, is some of my taste, all fairly graphic, I guess. But you know, people like Carl Bean, Zimmern Zoo, Jeff Nishinaka, like, you know, people I really sort of respected and admired, and people whose work had really caught my eye at the time.
Right.
And I guess it captures a moment in time as well. There's, because there's many books that have come out since, and you know, there seems to be many more paper artists around as well, which actually is quite exciting. It's nice to just see it like flourishing and, you know, new styles developing. But yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah. Well, thanks for contributing that to the world. And I love, again, what you said about embracing your fear. The same thing happened to me with my first book. I was very new to making paper by hand, just learning the ropes, and a publisher approached me and I was like,
amazing.
Whew, I better take this. This is an opportunity, you know? So I did, but it was,
It's hard to spot those opportunities sometimes.
Yeah.
It's it can be scary. It can be daunting.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about what you're working on right now.
Sure. So I've, currently got some work on for the BAFTAs in the UK, which is fun. So for an event that they're doing for the Television Craft Awards.
Oh.
So going to be hopefully doing some stuff for, they've got a big award ceremony, and we're going to be doing like the table centerpieces and things like that. Should be fun. So like a bit of an installation piece. So I've also recently just finished a campaign for a whiskey company called the Belveni. And that was a really fun one because it's been a huge array of different formats. Yeah, I created these paper sets for the bottles to sit in. And I thought that would be the end. That was all we kind of were approached to do to begin with. But then off the back of that, they've decided to do these amazing pop-up books which actually contain little miniatures of the whiskey in, and then they've done these huge versions of the sets for various airports and department stores. And then we've also teamed up with an animation studio who've kind of recreated my sets in CGI to then bring them to life. So it's been a real fascinating one, sort of working on one part and then just seeing it snowballing into this amazing array of outputs and outcomes. And that's really fun. But also, just working on, have some editorial work on, and like a real array of stuff at the moment. And also trying to work on a new show, I guess, because it's been a while since my last exhibition. I think the last one was maybe 4 years ago in San Francisco. I had like a solo show, and it just feels like time. Now I'm settled again in Brighton, feel like new surroundings. It'd be nice to try and develop something new again. So that's, yeah, but it's kind of fitting that all in around all of the other projects, yeah. Life, yeah. Family life, stuff like that.
Right. What percentage of your time on like what a project do you say is hands-on versus digital? Can you?
What's interesting actually is I say like on a job, like uh-huh. looking at a single job, I think the making time is sometimes for the smallest part, mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of, I feel like there's always quite a lot of pre-development, sketching, mocking up, back mm-hmm. and forth, trying to get it approved. And then you hit go on the making, and then making has to happen quite quickly because generally the timeline, you're sort of up against it by the time it's approved.
Right.
Then you have to make it quickly. And so I'm working on a magazine cover at the moment. And we've had like a week or so of like pre-designing doing, and then I've basically just got to make it tomorrow. Mm-hmm. That's my timeline, make it tomorrow, bit of Thursday, mm-hmm. and then editing, and then send a final file over. So I think the making side does tend to be like a slightly smaller mm-hmm. part of the job, but it depends on the project. The set design jobs are a lot more labor intensive than sure. the illustration pieces, which are a bit more straightforward. It's just factoring in that time, you know, for each job. Make sure you're not too rushed.
Yeah, cool. All right, and you had a couple of recommendations. Tell me about the Invisible Artist podcast.
Yeah, so it was actually a podcast I got recommended by a new friend of mine in Brighton who I've met through our kids playing in the park. Uh-huh. She's a textiles artist called Holly Turner. She runs a business called Raffi's Room, which I again want to give a shout out to. And I've got a piece of hers in the studio, actually. It's really beautiful sort of wall hangings that she hand makes. The podcast, it was really fascinating. It's just interviews with different creatives about their practice, mm-hmm. And sort of, I guess, like their path to success and their path in the creative world. And it's a nice one because I haven't found many podcasts which feature, I guess, kind of contemporary artists who are kind of within, I guess, a similar graphic spectrum to my interests, uh-huh. you know, in art, you know, a bit less down the craft route, kind of a bit more on that kind of contemporary graphic sphere. And they had a recent one with an artist called Ollie Fathers, whose work I love, and that was really fascinating. He's an artist from Brixton. I'd recommend checking that out. It's really interesting.
All right. And how about Paperist, the book? I think I just saw that somewhere else. I looked up the cover when you sent it, and is that a new book?
Yeah, it is a fairly new book. Yeah. Okay. I felt really honored to be asked to have a little chapter in it, but it's again, I guess, just another interesting collection of contemporary paper artists, a real array of artists doing various and sort of interesting, mm-hmm. exciting things. And it's kind of, it's, I guess, one of the first paper books I've been involved in for a little while, but it's interesting to see how like the art form has developed, a bunch of new artists coming up,
right?
And kind of sort of seeing where it's at compared to, say, when I did my book,
mm-hmm.
8 years ago or so, you know? Just another interesting one, and one I kind of feel like is worth picking up at the moment.
Right. Wonderful. And then Human Worth, your charitable record label.
Yeah, I thought I'd give that a shout out.
Yeah.
I think what I was going to say about this is I feel it's really, really important to maintain and hold on to your hobbies, mm-hmm. because I think I definitely found going into the sort of art world that I sort of dropped everything else, and a lot of people around me did as well. But actually regaining those hobbies, and mine's been drumming. I played a drum since I was 11. Uh-huh. And bringing that back into my life has been such a game changer, because I feel like the break sort of headspace I have away from work when I'm playing music, writing music, or involved in the music scene is really invaluable, because it means I can come back with a bit of a clear head. Mm-hmm. I sort of see projects I'm working on differently, and kind of just helps solve problems, just, you know, having that little breakaway. And so over the years, getting back into music, I eventually thought it'd be fun to start a little label. And actually some of the bands I'd met through the various scenes in and around London, start putting out music and giving a portion of profits to charity. So we give 10% of all of our proceeds to a charity of that band's choosing for each release. And it's really nice. It feels nice to be sort of giving back and doing it through a totally different means than my artwork, I guess, you know, just to have a bit of separation, to have something else going on. So yeah, it's been fun. And yeah, as I say, I think holding on to your hobbies is a key to, like, I guess, having a slightly more rounded lifestyle, you know?
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I know you just, you do give back through your art as well. I know you, during March, you have a shop online as well. Mm. We'll link to that in the show notes, but
thank you.
Where you sell some of your personal work. And you did a fundraiser for Ukraine.
Yes. Yeah. I was really, I just totaled that up today. I was really felt privileged and honored to have so many people buying stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's obviously such a hard time at the moment. And yeah. I feel like just any way to try and help support and give back is, you just, I guess everyone's just trying to do that bit at the moment, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Owen, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been wonderful getting
into
your career.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. And yeah, it was really nice to meet you finally kind of in person.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. See ya.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season.